11. Damaya at the fulcrum of it all. There's an order to life in the fulcrum. Waking comes with dawn. Since that's what Damaya always did back on the farm, this is easy for her. For the other grits, and that's what she is now, an unimportant bit of rock ready to be polished into usefulness, or at least to help grind other better rocks. Waking comes when one of the instructors enters the dormitory and rings a painfully loud bell, which makes them all flinch, even if they're already awake. Everyone groans, including Damaya. She likes this. It makes her feel like she's part of something. They rise and make their beds, folding the top sheets military style. Then they shuffle into the showers, which are white with electric lights and shining with tile, and which smell of herbal cleaners, because the fulcrum hires strongbacks and calmless from humanist shanty towns to come and clean them. For this and other reasons, the showers are wonderful. She's never been able to use hot water every day like this, tons of it, just falling from holes in the ceiling like the most perfect rain ever. She tries not to be obvious about it, because some of the other grits are equatorials and would laugh at her. The bumpkin, overwhelmed by the novelty of easy, comfortable cleanliness. But, well, she is. After that, the grits brush their teeth and come back to the dormitory room to dress and groom themselves. Their uniforms are stiff gray fabric pants and tunics with black piping, girls and boys alike. Children whose hair is long and locked, or thin enough to be combed and pulled back, must do so. Children whose hair is ash blow, or kinky or short, must make sure it's shaped neatly. Then the grits stand in front of their beds, waiting while instructors come in and move down the rows for inspection. They want to make sure the grits are actually clean. The instructors check the beds, too, to make sure no one's peed in theirs or done a shoddy job of folding the corners. Grits who aren't clean are sent back for another shower, this one cold, with the instructor standing there watching to make sure it's done right. Damaya makes sure she'll never have to do this, because it doesn't sound fun at all. Grits who haven't dressed and groomed themselves or tended the bed properly are sent to discipline, where they receive punishments suited to the infraction. Uncombed hair gets cut very short. Repeat offenders are shaven bald. Unbrushed teeth merit mouthwashing with soap. Incorrect dress is corrected with 5 switches across the naked buttocks or back. Incorrect bed making with 10. The switches do not break the skin. Instructors are trained to strike just enough. But they do leave welts, which are probably meant to chafe underneath the stiff fabric of the uniforms. "You are representatives of us all," the instructors say, if any grit dares to protest this treatment. "When you're dirty, all origins are dirty. When you're lazy, we're all lazy. We hurt you so you'll do the rest of us no harm." Once Damaya would have protested the unfairness of such judgments. The children of the fulcrum are all different. Different ages, different colors, different shapes. Some speak Sansamat with different accents, having originated from different parts of the world. One girl has sharp teeth because it is her race's custom to file them. Another boy has no penis, though he stuffs a sock into his underwear after every shower. Another girl has rarely had regular meals and wolfs down every one like she's still starving. The instructors keep finding food hidden in and around her bed. They make her eat it, all of it, in front of them, even if it makes her sick. One cannot reasonably expect sameness out of so much difference. And it makes no sense for Damaya to be judged by the behavior of children who share nothing save the curse of orogeny with her. But Damaya understands, now that the world is not fair. They are origins, the misalums of the world, born cursed and terrible. This is what is necessary to make them safe. Anyway, if she does what she's supposed to, no unexpected things happen. Her bed is always perfect, her teeth clean and white. When she starts to forget what matters, she looks at her right hand, which twinges now and again on cold days, though the bones healed within a few weeks. She remembers the pain and the lesson that it taught. After inspection, there is breakfast. Just a bit of fruit and a piece of sausage in the Sunzed fashion, which they pick up in the dormitory foyer and eat on the way. They walk in small groups to lessons in the various courts of the fulcrum that the older Grits call crucibles, though that's not what they're supposed to be called. There are many things the Grits say to each other that they can never say to the adults. The adults know, but pretend they don't. The world is not fair, and sometimes it makes no sense. In the first crucible, which is roofed over, the first hours of the day are spent in chairs with a slate board and a lecture by one of the fulcrum's instructors. Sometimes there are oral examinations with questions peppered at the Grits one by one until someone falters. The Grit who falters will have to clean the slate boards. Thus do they learn to work calmly under pressure. What was the name of the first old Sansa emperor? A shake in Erta emits push waves at 6:35 and 7 seconds, and vibrational waves at 6:37 and 27 seconds. What is the lag time? This question becomes more complex if it is asked of older Grits, going into logarithms and functions. Stone lore advises, watch for the center of the circle. Where is the fallacy in this statement? This is the question that lands on Demaya one day, so she stands to answer. The statement explains how one may estimate the location of an origin by map, she says. It is incorrect, oversimplified. Because an origin's region of consumption is not circular, it is toroidal. Many people then fail to understand that the zone of effect extends downward or upward as well, and can be deformed in other three-dimensional ways by a skilled origin. Instructor Markasite nods approval for this explanation, which makes Demaya feel proud. She likes being right. Markasite continues. And since stone lore would be harder to remember if it was full of phrases like, watch for the inverted fulcrum of a conical torus, we get centers and circles. Accuracy is sacrificed in the name of better poetry. This makes the class laugh. It's not that funny, but there's a lot of nervous tension on quiz days. After lectures, there is lunch in the big open-air court set aside for that purpose. This court has a roof of oiled canvas strips on slats, which can be rolled shut on rainy days, although Eumenes, which is far inland, rarely has such days. So the Grits usually get to sit at long bench tables under a bright blue sky as they giggle and kick each other and call each other names. There's lots of food to make up for the light breakfast, all of it varied and delicious and rich, though much of it is from distant lands, and Demaya does not know what some of it is called. She eats her share anyway. Medir taught her never to waste food. This is Demaya's favorite time of day, even though she is one of the Grits who sit alone at an empty table. Many of the other children do this, she has noticed. Too many to dismiss them all as those who failed to make friends. The others have a look to them that she is rapidly learning to recognize, a certain furtiveness of movement, a hesitancy, a tension about the eyes and jawline. Some of them bear the marks of their old lives in a more obvious way. There is a gray-haired Western Coaster boy who's missing an arm above the elbow, though he is deft enough at managing without it. A Sunset girl, maybe 5 years older, has the twisting seams of old burn scars all down one side of her face. And then there is another Grit, even newer than Demaya, whose left hand is in a special leather binding like a glove without fingers, which fastens around the wrist. Demaya recognizes this binding because she wore it herself while her hand healed during her first few weeks at the fulcrum. They do not look at each other much, she and these others who sit off to themselves. After lunch, the Grits travel through the ring garden in long, silent lines, overseen by the instructors so that they will not talk or stare too obviously at the adult origins. Demaya does stare, of course, because they're supposed to. It's important that they see what awaits them once they begin earning rings. The garden is a wonder, as are the origins themselves. Adult and elderly of every conformation, all healthy and beautiful, confident, which makes them beautiful. All are starkly forbidding in their black uniforms and polished boots. Their ringed fingers flick and flash as they gesture freely, or turn the pages of books they don't have to read, or brush back a lover's curling hair from one ear. What Demaya sees in them is something she does not understand at first, though she wants it with a desperation that surprises and unnerves her. As those first weeks pass into months and she grows familiar with the routine, she begins to understand what it is that the older origins display. Control. They have mastered their power. No ringed origin would ice the courtyard just because some boy shoved her. None of these sleek, black-clad professionals would bat so much as an eyelash at either a strong earthquake or a family's rejection. They know what they are, and they have accepted all that means, and they fear nothing. Not the stills, not themselves, not even old man Earth. If to achieve this, Demaya must endure a few broken bones or a few years in a place where no one loves or even likes her, that is a small price to pay. Thus, she pours herself into the afternoon training in applied orogeny. In the practice cubicles, which are situated within the innermost ring of the fulcrum complex, Demaya stands in a row with other grits of a similar level of experience. There, under an instructor's watchful gaze, she learns how to visualize and breathe, and to extend her awareness of the earth at will, and not merely in reaction to its movements or her own agitation. She learns to control her agitation and all the other emotions that can induce the power within her to react to a threat that does not exist. The grits have no fine control at this stage, so none of them are allowed to actually move anything. The instructors can tell somehow when they're about to, and because the instructors all have rings, they can pierce any child's developing torus in a way that Demaya does not yet understand, administering a quick, stunning slap of icy cold air as a warning. It is a reminder of the seriousness of the lesson, and it also lends credence to a rumor that the older grits have whispered in the dark after lights out. If you make too many mistakes in the lessons, the instructors ice you. It will be many years before Demaya understands that when the instructors kill an errant student, it is meant not as a goad, but as a mercy. After applied comes dinner and free hour, a time in which they may do what they please, allowed in deference to their youth. The newest grits usually fall into bed early, exhausted by the effort of learning to control invisible, semi-voluntary muscles. The older children have better stamina and more energy, so there's laughter and play around the dormitory bunks for a while, until the instructors declare lights out. The next day, it all begins again. Thus do 6 months pass. One of the older grits comes over to Demaya at lunch. The boy is tall and equatorial, though he doesn't look fully sonsed. His hair has the ashblow texture, but it's backwater blonde in color. He's got the broad shoulders and developing bulk of Strongback, which makes her wary at once. She still sees Zob everywhere. The boy smiles, though, and there is no menace in his manner as he stops beside the small table she inhabits alone. Can I sit down? She shrugs, because she doesn't want him to, but is curious despite herself. He puts down his tray and sits. I'm Arkete, he says. That's not your name, she replies, and his smile falters a little. It's the name my parents gave me, he says more seriously, and it's the name I intend to keep until they find a way to take it from me, which they'll never do because, well, you know, it's a name. But if you'd rather, I'm officially called Mashish. The highest quality grade of aquamarine, used almost exclusively for art. It suits him. He's a handsome boy, despite his obvious Arctic or Antarctic heritage. She doesn't care, but equatorials do. And that makes him dangerous in the sharp, faceted way that handsome big boys have always been. She decides to call him Mashish because of this. What do you want?
Wow, you're really working on your popularity.
Mashish starts eating, resting his elbows on the table while he chews. But he checks to make sure there are no instructors around to chide him on his manners first.
You know how these things are supposed to work, right? The good-looking, popular guy suddenly shows interest in the mousy girl from the country. Everyone hates her for it, but she starts to gain confidence in herself. Then the guy betrays her and regrets it. It's awful, but afterward she finds herself, realizes she doesn't need him, and maybe there's some other stuff that happens.
He waggles his fingers in the air.
And finally, she turns into the most beautiful girl ever because she likes herself. But it won't work at all if you don't stammer and blush and pretend you don't like me.
She's utterly confused by this salad of words. It annoys her so much that she says, I don't like you.
Ouch.
He pantomimes being stabbed in the heart. In spite of herself, his antics do make Demaya relax a little. This makes him grin in turn.
Ah, that's better. What, don't you read books? Or didn't you have lorists in whatever mid-ladder hole you came from?
She doesn't read books, because she's not very good at reading yet. Her parents taught her enough to get by, and the instructors have assigned her a weekly regimen of additional reading to improve her skills in this area. But she's not about to admit that. Of course we had lorists. They taught us stone lore and told us how to prepare.
Ugh, you had real lorists.
The boy shakes his head.
Where I grew up, nobody listened to them except creche teachers and the most boring geomests. What everybody liked instead were the pop lorists. You know, the kind who perform in amphitheaters and bars. Their stories don't teach anything. They're just fun.
Demaya has never heard of this, but maybe it's some equatorial fad that never made it to the nomad lats. But lorists tell stone lore. That's the whole point. If these people don't even do that, shouldn't they be called, I don't know, something else?
Maybe.
He shrugs and reaches over to steal a piece of cheese from her plate. She's so flustered by the pop lorist thing that she doesn't protest.
The real lorists have been complaining about them to the humanescent leadership, but that's all I know about it.
They brought me here 2 years ago, and I haven't heard anything since. He sighs.
I hope the pop lorists don't go away, though. I like them, even if their stories are a little stupid and predictable. Of course, their stories are set in real creches, not places like this.
His lips twitch down at the corners as he looks around at their surroundings in faint disapproval. Demaya knows full well what he means, but she wants to know if he'll say. Places like this? His eyes slide sidelong back to hers, flashing his teeth in a smile that probably charms more people than it alarms, he says.
Oh, you know? Beautiful, wonderful, perfect places full of love and light.
Demaya laughs, then stops herself. She's not sure why she did, either.
Yeah, The boy resumes eating with relish. Took me a while to laugh after I got here, too. She likes him a little after this statement. He doesn't want anything, she realizes after a time. He makes small talk and eats her food, which is all right since she was mostly finished anyway. He doesn't seem to mind when she calls him Mashish. She still doesn't trust him, but he just seems to want someone to talk with, which she can understand. Eventually, he stands and thanks her for this scintillating conversation, which was almost entirely one-sided on his part, and then heads off to rejoin his friends. She puts it out of her mind and goes on about her day. Except, the next day something changes. It starts that morning in the shower, when someone bumps into her hard enough to make her drop her washcloth. When she looks around, none of the boys or girls sharing the shower with her look in her direction or apologize. She chalks it up to an accident. When she gets out of the shower, however, someone has stolen her shoes. They were with her clothes, which she'd prepared before the shower and laid out on her bed to speed up the process of getting dressed. She always does this every morning. Now they're gone. She looks for them, methodically, trying to make sure she hasn't forgotten them somewhere, even though she knows she hasn't. And when she looks around at the other grits, who are carefully not looking at her, as the instructors call inspection, and she can do nothing but stand there in her impeccable uniform and bare feet, she knows what's happening. She fails inspection and is punished with a scrub brushing, which leaves her soles raw and stinging for the rest of the day inside the new shoes they give her. This is only the beginning. That evening at dinner, someone puts something in the juice she is given with her meal. Grits with poor table manners are given kitchen duty, which means they have access to everyone's food. She forgets this and does not think about the odd taste of the juice until it becomes hard to focus and her head starts hurting. Even then, she's not sure what's happening as she stumbles and lurches on her way back to the dormitory. One of the instructors pulls her aside, frowning at her lack of coordination, and sniffs her breath. "How much have you had to drink?" the man asks. Demaya frowns, confused at first because she just had a regular-sized glass of juice. The reason it takes her a while to understand is that she's drunk. Someone has slipped alcohol into her juice. Origins aren't supposed to drink, ever. The power to move mountains plus inebriation equals disaster waiting to happen. The instructor who stopped Demaya is Galena, one of the younger four-ringers who runs the afternoon orogeny drills. He's merciless in the crucible, but for whatever reason, he takes pity on her now. Galena takes her out of lineup and brings her to his own quarters, which are fortunately nearby. There he puts Demaya on a couch and commands her to sleep it off. In the morning, as Demaya drinks water and winces at the awful taste in her mouth, Galena sits her down and says, "You need to deal with this now. If any of the seniors had caught you," he shakes his head. It's an offense so severe that there's no standing punishment. It would be terrible. That's all either of them needs to understand. It doesn't matter why the other grits have decided to bully her. All that matters is that they're doing it, and that these are no harmless pranks. They're trying to get her iced. Galena's right. Demaya's got to deal with this now. She decides she needs an ally. There's another girl among the loners that she's noticed. Everyone notices this girl. There's something wrong with her. Her orogeny is a precarious, pent thing, a dagger constantly poised to plunge into the earth. And training has only made it worse, because now the knife is sharper. That's not supposed to happen. Selu is her name, and she hasn't yet earned or been given an origin name. But the other grits call her Crack, to be funny. And that is the name that has stuck. She even answers to that name since she can't seem to stop them from using it. everyone's already whispering that she won't make it, which means she's perfect. Demaya makes her move on crack after breakfast the next day. She drinks only water now, which she has drawn from a nearby fountain. She has to eat the food they serve her, but she inspects it carefully before putting anything in her mouth. "Hi," she says, setting her tray down. Crack eyes her. "Really? Things are bad enough that you need me." It's a good sign that they can be honest with each other right off. "Yes," Demaya says, and sits, since Crack hasn't really objected. "They're messing with you too, aren't they?" "Of course they are. Demaya hasn't seen whatever they're doing, but it only makes sense. There's an order to life in the Fulcrum." Crack sighs. This makes the room reverberate faintly, or so it feels for an instant. Demaya makes herself not react, because a good partnership should not begin with a display of fear. Crack sees this and relaxes, just a little. The judder of imminent disaster fades. "Yeah," Crack says softly. Demaya realizes all of a sudden that Crack is angry, though she keeps her gaze on her plate. It's there in the way she holds her fork too tightly and the way her expression is too blank. All at once, Demaya wonders, is Crack's control really a problem? Or is it simply that her tormentors have done their best to make her crack? "So, what do you want to do about it?" Demaya outlines her plan. After an initial flinch, Crack realizes she is serious. They finish eating in silence, while Crack thinks it over. At last, Crack says, "I'm in." The plan is really quite simple. They need to find the head of the serpent, and the best way to do that is to use bait. They decide on Mashish, because of course Mashish must be involved. Demaya's troubles began right after his ostensibly friendly overtures. They wait until he's in the shower one morning, laughing with his friends, and then Demaya returns to her bunk. "Where are my shoes?" she asks loudly. The other grits look around, some of them groan, all too ready to believe that bullies would be uncreative enough to pull the same trick twice. Jasper, who's only been in the Fulcrum a few months longer than Demaya, scowls. "Nobody took your shoes this time," he says. "They're in your trunk." "How do you know? Did you take them?" Demaya moves to confront him, and he bristles and meets her in the middle of the room, his shoulders back with a front. "I didn't take your crap. If they're lost, you lost them." "I don't lose things." She jabs him in the chest with a finger. He's a nomad ladder like her, but thin and pale, probably from some calm close to the Arctic. He turns red when he's angry. The other kids make fun of this, but not much, because he teases other kids more loudly. Good orogeny is deflection, not cessation. "If you didn't take them, then you know who did." She jabs him again, and he swats her hand away. "Don't touch me, you stupid little pig. I'll break your rusting finger. What is this?" They all jump and fall silent and turn. In the doorway, ready to begin evening inspection, is Carnelian, one of the few seniors among the instructors. He's a big man, bearded and older and severe, with 6 rings. They're all afraid of him. In token of which, the grits immediately scramble into their places before the bunks, standing at attention. Demaya, in spite of herself, feels a bit of trepidation, until she catches Crack's eye, and Crack gives her a small nod. The distraction was enough.
"I said, what is this?"
Carnelian comes into the room once they're assembled. He focuses on Jasper, who's still apple red, though probably with fear rather than anger this time.
"Is there some problem?"
Jasper glares at Demaya.
"Not with me, instructor."
When Carnelian turns to her, she is ready. Someone stole my shoes, instructor.
Again?
This is a good sign. Last time, Carnelian simply berated her for losing her own shoes and making excuses.
You have proof it was Jasper who stole them?
Here's the tricky part. She's never been good at lying. I know it was a boy. They disappeared during the last shower, and all the girls were in there with me. I counted.
Carnelian sighs. If you're trying to blame someone else for your shortcomings,
she's always doing that, says a red-haired Eastern Coaster girl.
She's got a lot of shortcomings, says a boy who looks like he comes from the same com,
if he's not a relative of hers outright. Half the grits snicker.
Search the boys' chests.
Demaya speaks over their laughter. It's something she didn't ask for last time, because she wasn't sure where the shoes would be. This time she is sure.
There wasn't much time to get rid of the shoes. They have to still be here. Look in their chests.
That's not fair,
says one tiny equatorial boy who looks barely old enough to be out of the toddler's crash.
No, it isn't, says Carnelian,
his scowl deepening as he looks at her.
Be very certain before you ask me to violate your fellow trainees' privacy. If you're wrong, we won't go easy on you this time.
She still remembers the sting of brush-scrubbed feet. I understand, instructor. Carnelian sighs. Then he turns to the boys' side of the dormitory room.
Open your trunks, all of you. Let's get this over with.
There's a lot of grumbling as they open their chests, and enough glares that Demaya knows she's made things worse for herself. They all hate her now, which is fine. If they're going to hate her, she'd rather they do it for a reason. But that might change once this game has played out.
Mashish opens his chest along with the rest, sighing mortally as he does so, and her shoes are right there on top of the folded uniforms.
When Demaya sees his expression change from annoyance to confusion and then mortification, she feels bad. She doesn't like hurting people. But she watches closely, and the instant Mashish's expression changes to fury, he swings around and glares at someone. She follows his glare, tense, ready, to see that he's looking at Jasper.
Yes, that was what she expected. He's the one then.
Jasper, though, has suddenly gone pale. He shakes his head, as if trying to throw off Mashish's accusatory look. It doesn't work. Instructor Carnelian sees all of this. A muscle in his jaw flexes as he glances toward Demaya again. He looks almost angry with her, but why? He must understand that she has to do this.
I see,
he says, as if responding to her thought. Then he focuses on Mashish.
Do you have anything to say for yourself?
Mashish doesn't protest his innocence. She can see by the slump of his shoulders and the shaking of his fists that he knows there's no point. But he's not going down alone. With his head down, he says,
Jasper took her shoes last time.
I did not.
Jasper backs away from his bunk in the inspection line into the middle of the room. He's trembling all over. Even his eyes are trembling. He looks ready to cry.
He's lying. He's just trying to pass this off on someone else.
But when Carnelian turns to Jasper, Jasper flinches and goes still. He almost spits the next words.
She sold them for me. Traded them to one of the cleaning comlists in exchange for liquor.
And then he points at crack. Demaya inhales, everything inside her going still with shock.
Crack?
Crack.
You rusting cannibal son whore.
Crack clenches her fists.
You let that old pervert feel you up for liquor and a letter. You know full well he wouldn't give it to us just for shoes.
It was from my mother.
Jasper's definitely crying now.
I didn't want him to... But I couldn't. They wouldn't let me write to her.
You liked it, Crack sneers. I told you I'd tell if you said anything, didn't I? Well, I saw you. He had his fingers in you, and you moaned like it felt good, just like the little wannabe breeder you are. Only breeders have standards.
This is wrong. This is all wrong. Everyone's staring at each other, at Crack as she rants, at Demaya, at Jasper as he weeps, at Carnelian. The room is full of gasps and murmurings. That feeling is back. The pent, fraught, not quite reverberation that is Crack's orogeny unfurling itself, and everyone in the room is twitching with it. Or maybe they're twitching at the words and what they mean, because these aren't things grits should know or do. Getting in trouble, sure, they're kids and kids do that. Getting in trouble like this? No.
No,
Jasper wails the word at Crack.
I told you not to tell.
He's sobbing openly now. His mouth works, but nothing more comes out that's intelligible, nothing but a low, despairing moan. Or maybe it's just a continuation of the word no.
Impossible to tell, because everyone else is making noise now. Some of them hissing at Crack to shut up. Some sniffing with Jasper, some of them giggling nervously at Jasper's tears, some of them stage whispering at each other for confirmation of things they knew but didn't believe.
Enough!
The room goes silent with Carnelian's quiet command, except for Jasper's soft hitching. After a moment, Carnelian's jaw flexes.
You, you, and you.
He points at Mashish, Jasper, and Crack.
Come with me.
He walks out of the room. The three grits look at each other, and it's a wonder none of them combust from the sheer hatred in these looks. Then Mashish curses and moves to follow Carnelian. Jasper scrubs a forearm across his face and does the same, his head hanging and fists tight. Crack glares around the room, defiant, until her eyes meet Demaya's. Then Crack flinches. Demaya stares back because she's too stunned to look away and because she is furious with herself. This is what comes of trusting others. Crack was not her friend, wasn't even someone she liked, but she thought they could at least help each other. Now she's found the head of the snake that's been trying to eat her. And it's halfway down the gullet of a completely different snake. The result is something too obscene to look at, let alone kill.
Better you than me,
Crack says softly, into the room's silence. Demaya hasn't said anything, hasn't demanded an explanation, but Crack gives her one anyway, right there, in front of everyone. No one says a word. No one even breathes loudly. That was the idea. One more slip up and I'm done for, but you. You're little citizen perfect. Top scores on all the tests. Perfect control in applied, not a wrinkle out of place. The instructors wouldn't really do much to you, not yet. And while they were trying to figure out how their star pupil suddenly went wrong, everyone would stop waiting for me to blow up a mountain. Or trying to make me do it. For a while, anyway. Her smile fades and she looks away. That was the idea. Demaya can't say anything. She can't even think. So after a while, Crack shakes her head, sighs, and moves to follow the others after Carnelian. The room is still. Nobody looks at anybody else. Then there's a stir at the door, as two other instructors come in and begin examining Crack's bunk and trunk. The grits watch as one woman lifts the mattress and the other ducks under it. There's a brief ripping sound, and the instructor reappears with a big brown flask half full in one hand. She opens the flask and sniffs its contents, grimaces, and nods to the other woman. They both leave. When the echoes of their steps fade, Damaya goes to Mashisha's trunk to retrieve her shoes. She closes the lid. The sound is very loud in the silence. No one moves until she goes back to her own bunk and sits down to put the shoes on. As if this is a signal, there are several sighs, and some of the others start moving too, retrieving books for the next lesson, filing off to First Crucible, going over to the sideboard where breakfast waits. When Damaya goes to the sideboard herself, another girl glances at her, then away quickly. "Sorry," she mutters. "I'm the one who pushed you in the shower." Damaya looks at her and sees lurking fear making the skin around her eyes tight. "It's okay," she says softly. "Don't worry about it." The other grits never give Damaya trouble again. A few days later, Mashish returns with broken hands and haunted eyes. He never speaks to Damaya again. Jasper does not return, but Carnelian tells them he's been sent to the satellite fulcrum up in Arctic, since the fulcrum of Eumenes holds too many bad memories for him. This was meant as a kindness, perhaps, but Damaya knows an exile when she sees one. It could be worse, though. No one ever sees or mentions Crack again. Fungus Season, 602 Imperial. A series of oceanic eruptions during the eastern equatorial monsoons increased humidity in the region and obscured sunlight for 6 months. While this was a mild season as such things go, its timing created perfect conditions for a fungal bloom that spread across the equatorials into the northern and southern midlats, wiping out then-staple crop Mirok, now extinct. The resulting famine is included in the official geomestric record, extending the season's length to 4 years, 2 years for the fungus blight to run its course, two more for agriculture and food distribution systems to recover. Nearly all affected comms were able to subsist on their own stores, thus proving the efficacy of imperial reforms and seasonal planning. In its aftermath, many comms of the Nomidlats and Somidlats voluntarily joined the Empire, beginning its golden age. From The Seasons of Sansa.